From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of our program, an extended interview with the actor and social media maven Stephen Fry. He has traveled the world confronting the global lawmakers who seek to outlaw homosexuality.
Gay people, most of them are lying about their problems because most of them would like to be favored and famous because they're victims of Russian medieval behavior.
A cultural icon in Britain, Stephen Fry talks about the extremes he encountered, making his BBC series Out There. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts with the latest world news. US officials say they have seen no evidence to back up claims by the Iraqi prime minister that Islamic State militants are plotting an imminent attack on the underground systems in New York and Paris. He was speaking in New York, where he's attending the UN General Assembly. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi told reporters in New York Iraqi intelligence uncovered a plot by foreign-born fighters with Islamic State to attack the Paris and New York underground systems. U.S. government officials say they've seen no evidence to back up the claim, which comes just as Mr. Abadi seeks fresh global support in the battle against Islamic State militants. The New York Police Department says it's aware of his claim and is now consulting with the FBI. Simon Marks, Washington.
The FBI says it has identified the Islamic State militant involved in the beheading of two American journalists and a British aid worker. Jihadi John, as he's become known, appeared in all three execution videos, speaking in a UK accent. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Jihadi John has become one of the most wanted men in the world, and his clearly British accent has brought home vividly to the British public that Britons are not just fighting in the region, but that some are involving themselves in shocking crimes. His identification may not immediately help security officials in the sense that knowing who he is doesn't necessarily help with where he is right now or with stopping further executions. But clearly intelligence officials on both sides of the Atlantic will be scrambling to gather as many clues as possible as to where Jihadi John is now that they know his identity. And also any clues from his family and friends as to how he became so radicalized in the first place.
US military officials believe they've successfully destroyed mobile oil refineries used by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant in the latest round of airstrikes against positions inside Syria. It's estimated the Islamic militants make as much as $2 million per day on petroleum products refined at these locations. US Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby confirmed the airstrikes around Deir ez-Zor.
We are still assessing the outcomes of these attacks, but initially we believe they were successful. I'm going to show you some imagery in just a minute to demonstrate where that confidence comes from. These small-scale refineries provide fuel to run ISIL operations, money to finance their continued attacks throughout Iraq and Syria, and they are an economic asset to support future operations.
Iran's president has blamed Western nations for the current violence in the Middle East. Hassan Rouhani, addressing the UN General Assembly, also appeared to tie cooperation on tackling extremism in the region to talks on Iran's nuclear program. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The World Health Organization is reporting nearly 3,000 have died from Ebola, and there are nearly 6,500 confirmed cases. The rapid spread of the epidemic, which may infect more than 20,000 in the next month in Africa, was the reason for a special session at the United Nations General Assembly on the global response. U.S. President Barack Obama underscored the urgency of responding to the Ebola epidemic.
But this is also more than a health crisis. This is a growing threat to regional and global security. I want us to be clear. We are not moving fast enough.
France has been holding crisis talks after the beheading of a French tourist in Algeria by a terrorist group supporting Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria. Ahead of the meeting, French officials suggested all operations, including continuing airstrikes in Iraq and action in Syria, would be looked at again. American Matthew Todd Miller says he's doing 8 hours of agriculture work each day as part of a 6-year sentence in North Korea for espionage. A television crew from the Associated Press was able to film him making a phone call to his family. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
Matthew Todd Miller says his health is good. He has been sentenced to 6 years hard labor for illegally entering North Korea to commit espionage. That's according to the regime of Kim Jong-un. He told a crew from Associated Press Television, prison life is 8 hours of work per day. Mostly it's been agriculture, such as digging around in the dirt. But other than that, it's isolation with no contact with anyone. He's one of three Americans being held by Pyongyang for alleged crimes. Top U.S. officials, including Special Representative for North Korea Policy, Glenn Davies, will travel to China, South Korea, and Japan to discuss the long-stalled six-party talks over North Korea's nuclear ambitions and human rights violations. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. On today's program, an extended interview with the British actor Stephen Fry. He became well known to American audiences when he played the role of Prime Minister Alistair Davis in the latest series of the Kiefer Sutherland TV drama 24. In Britain, he's been a cultural icon for decades, a comedian, writer, activist, and on Twitter, a global celebrity. With more than 7 million people following his social media messages daily. Jewish and gay, he is proud of his identity and recently hosted a series of television programmes for the BBC about the conditions facing the LGBT community worldwide. He travelled the world to challenge lawmakers introducing anti-gay legislation, like Vitaly Milonov, the Russian parliamentarian, behind laws that ban the promotion of homosexuality.
We would be quite unhappy in case some inadequate individual would invade kindergarten trying to explain to minors that they should identify their sexual identity.
They don't invade kindergartens and tell children to have their sexual identity. That is absolute nonsense. You're inventing a ridiculous enemy to get support so that ignorant people will imagine there is this terrible threat to children. The real threat to children is, as it always was, ignorance, lies. Because they will grow up to find out they've been lied to, and they won't thank you for it.
Stephen Fry on his BBC television programme Out There. He sat down recently to discuss the films with James O'Brien of Britain's LBC Radio.
I decided about 2.5 years ago and put it to some friends in the production business, as it were, that it was perhaps a good idea to look around the world, different emerging economies, especially the important big ones like Brazil and Russia and India, and see what the attitude towards homosexuality was. And I say was because it's such a fast-moving thing. And since we sort of locked and edited these two films we made on the subject, things have changed bizarrely. I went to St. Petersburg to confront the man responsible for a piece of legislation making it illegal to promote homosexuality to minors, whatever that means, and how you promote homosexuality, I've yet to discover. And in the time between interviewing him, which was in itself farcically hilarious, it has become now federal, or whatever word they use, I think it is federal, law in all of Russia.
Was there a trigger that 2.5 years ago? Was it just a sort of thought bubble that ignited above your head, or did you encounter something, read something that made you think, I want to do a bit more about this?
I think it was hearing about the prospect of it happening in St. Petersburg. And as it happens, I love Russia, and I love things Russian. I sort of grew up adoring Russian literature and plays and music, and it just struck me as extraordinary that the city that gave birth to Diaghilev and Nureyev and Tchaikovsky, the greatest Russian artists, well, he didn't give birth to all of them, but certainly Tchaikovsky, should be doing this, should be suddenly allowing a piece of legislation which, on the surface, of course, seems perfectly measured It's just saying that you're not allowed to promote homosexuality as an equal or viable way of life to somebody under 18. But what it's actually doing is giving license, and this has been shown every day with increasing force and violence, giving license to brute squads of sort of shaven-headed neo-Nazis, endorsed by the Orthodox Church, which has hugely encouraged this. They're violently anti-homosexual as well, and I mean violently. They promote from the pulpit with violence, and that really is disturbing in a country as important as Russia. I mean, it's disturbing anyway.
Of course, and I mean, it happens in plenty of other countries as well, many of which you visit. You didn't have to go to Uganda, by the way, to find a radio phone-in that was occasionally populated by ranting homophobes. We could have made room for you here in Leicester Square on that occasion. But in a way, it's a sort of cart before the horse scenario, because the legislation follows from that strange impulse that some men, occasionally women, but usually men, this strange impulse they have to attack what the film you mentioned, that it's very funny, and it is, but it's a grim humor, the obsession with body parts. And I would have thought a man of your intellect and proclivities would have spent a lot more time than most of us wondering over the years where that comes from, and yet you seem as befuddled and as dismayed by it as everybody else is.
I am basically mystified as to why someone should spend so much energy and anger, so much rage should be vented against other people's lives that don't impinge on their own. I mean, they rested on three utterly fallacious assumptions. One, that people choose to be gay, which is so manifestly untrue, and especially true in countries like Iran and Iraq and Russia, where the price of that choice is such violence and such hatred and such a life of suffering.
And death.
The other, that having made that choice, you then try and recruit others to be gay. Particularly the youth, you recruit, because you need to do that for some reason, which, I mean, that's just insane. I mean, it's just a black lie. It's like the blood libel against the Jews. It's just simply a lie. That gay people are not interested in other people being gay. There are enough gay people to go around, and we're all perfectly happy, thank you. And we don't need anybody else to. It's quite more common the other way. I often hear gays, straight women saying, oh, why are all the nice men gay? They would be the ones trying to recruit gay people into being straight. And in fact, all my life I've been recruited into being straight. That's to say, when I was a child, 100% of every film I watched, of every magazine, you know, all the Carry-Ons and the James Bonds and everything like that, and all my friends were going, oh, look at the bazonkas on her, and you know, everything was telling me to be straight.
So if sexuality was negotiable, no one would be gay in the modern world.
Nobody. We'd all be straight, because everything, especially from my generation, because there was absolutely nothing but, that's your life, that's what. Even if it's you're watching a 30s weepy, you're watching, you know, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman or whatever, and it's all about you know, love and marriage and
Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor.
Yes, exactly, precisely. Even if it happened to be a bit of a lie, And then the third most pernicious one is that there's a sort of hint of paedophilia, that we must protect our children from these gay people because they want to interfere with them, which is just monstrous and grossly wrong. People hate the paedophilia acts as much as straight people.
Well, of course they do. And it should go without saying, but for the reasons
consent
you detail.
Consent means consent. Precisely. You cannot have consensual sex with someone, you know, below a certain age.
But nothing has actually changed for millennia with those three things.
No,
has it? I mean, because presumably that was the origin of the religious homophobia, would be to try and grow the congregation through procreation.
Yes, so that's part of it. In fact, there was a Brazilian senator I spoke to in my visit to Brazil, which is a fascinatingly complex and ambiguous country, because on the one hand, it does have some of the best carnivals and parades. The São Paulo carnival is the biggest in the world. Their gay parade is 4 million people. Until you've seen 4 million people in the streets, you haven't seen it. Anything.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it's just simply incredible. You stood in the same spot and waited for them all to pass. Hours and hours and hours, you'd have to stand. And, of course, a lot of the people at the parade are straight. They're really dancing around, celebrating with their support and so on. But the darker side to it is I've had a bleak and miserable, terribly sad evening speaking to this wonderful woman who lost her 14-year-old son, who was devastatingly tortured and beaten to death by a gang in Rio. And there's a gay person commits suicide every 36 hours in Brazil. It's a pretty terrible statistic. And I spoke to this right-wing senator who was trying to roll back equality laws. And he used the argument about what's natural. And I said, well, I'm glad you raised that, because before I set out, I have friends who are zoologists, and we sort of agreed between us that maybe between 400 and 600 animal species have exhibited homosexual behaviour that's been noted by professional zoologists. But only one species on Earth has ever exhibited homophobic behaviour. That's mankind. And that made him very angry. He didn't like that at all. I don't know why we're talking about that. It's not relevant, you know.
Well, it's difficult intellectually as well, isn't it? Because, of course, that means the people you need to take the argument to are the people who are going to be least receptive of your findings. So who are you thinking of when you made the film, if anyone in particular? Because you preach beautifully to the converted, but presumably
exactly,
you're aiming
to do. And I was hoping that people would be would have enough curiosity, enough human curiosity, not necessarily even intellectual curiosity, because I don't think it's an intellectual matter. It's a question of human curiosity to see the life stories of the incredible bravery of young men and women living in cultures where they are trying to live out the identity that has been given to them by their nature with as much pride and dignity as they can, and support for their fellows in the face of governments that are likely to not allow them to meet together in public, not allow them to have health checks, not allow them, you know, any of the normal dignities of a citizen. To see that, also to try and penetrate the mystery of the extreme homophobia, and to register something in the world, which is not the most important thing in the world. I mean, it's, of course, it's special pleading on my case. There's misery and poverty and hunger and abuse and war and chemical warfare and so many dreadful things going on in the world. And I go where my own personal curiosity takes me, because I think the fact is, if I was to do a series about railway engines, yes, people would say, that's not a real passion of yours, Stephen. I can sort of tell.
It's a little transparent.
You might have read it up very well, and yes, you're talking to the camera and saying, in this year, this particular mallard was built and it achieved these speeds.
There's people in front of you in the queue.
There are many people in front of me in the queue for that. But this is something where I have some interest in it, both personal and through friends, and
of course,
and through through cultural and human curiosity. I've been very, very lucky. I mean, I'm in a profession where being gay is hardly a stunning surprise. There was just the odd occasion at FA Cup finals when I've suddenly seen some skinhead shout at me, and I thought it was a joke at first, and then seen a fury in their faces. Yes. Fortunately, they've been far enough from me not to get to me. And I was present where the chairman of Millwall, when we were with my club Norwich, I was at the director's box, and someone shouted very, very obscene, both anti-Semitic and homophobic remark at me. And I was extremely impressed by the owner, who was American, who immediately just pointed and banned the guy from the ground for life. He said, we have zero tolerance. I know Millwall has a reputation, and we're changing all that. We have absolute zero tolerance of any of that kind of stuff.
So you've never been frightened then?
No, I haven't, I'm lucky to say. I mean, I live in the middle of London, and it always passes through you. I can imagine how women must feel when they walk alone at night, yes, sometimes. Because even, I'm sure you've had it yourself, you're walking alone at night on a London street, and you suddenly think, we all read of bizarre, absolutely meaningless, cruel, unnecessary, horrific attacks on people. You and I are men, so I don't look particularly gay, though, because I'm well-known, people might know I am, and I sometimes think, there's a cluster of young people over there with hoods, I think I'll probably go another way, And then I think, what must it like to be a woman walking on your own? And you hear footsteps behind you. Jeez, whiz, yes, And so I try and do that very careful male thing, that if there is a woman ahead of me, I talk on the telephone or pretend to, or cross the street just to put them at ease, because I think just to let them know that I'm not a mad stalker.
Of course, you probably end up coming across even madder.
Exactly. Why is this man pretending to have a telephone conversation?
He looks like Stephen Fry as well. That's even weirder.
And why is he saying, yes, mother, this will be number four, mother?
No, of course. So, and you use the word lucky. You are lucky, because you could quite conceivably...
That's the point. I'm not, you know, it's not a factory job or a shelf-stacking job in some town where it's routine to speak about, let alone the, oh, that's a bit gay, which is, you know, I can... Personally, I'm not as affronted by that as some gay people are. You know, I find it quite funny. It's just, well, that's a bit gay, isn't it? You know, I think it was a compliment of something.
Basically. Of course.
But the playground taunting, the, you know, the real serious bullying by Facebook or similar, that must be absolutely awful.
Can you really conceive of a world in which it won't happen?
I think, you know, progress is such a desperate business. You took two steps forward, one back, and sometimes two forward and then two back, back where you were. This year has seen the Queen signing into law the same-sex marriage bill, which is really extraordinary when you think about it. And yet, I remember in the 70s when I was a teenager, a lot of people voting against the equal pay for women that came in under Ted Heath. And you think, what? Some of them will still be alive. What? They actually voted against women getting equal pay. Now it's completely unquestioned.
Because there were women who didn't like the suffragettes, weren't there?
Well, yeah, they
went far enough. Well, why do you think they go in hand in hand? Because
women are not a minority after all.
Precisely. I probably am exposed to these sort of thoughts a little bit more than you are professionally, because I've been a radio phone-in show, obviously. And it's
a filter for madness. We're very grateful to you.
Occasionally it can feel like that. And yet, quite often, the angriest people are not only angry with the gays, they're also angry with the blacks and the women. Why do you think those three... Because the explanation of almost being fearful of what might be your true self works with homosexuality. It doesn't work with
the other two. Sort of distorted and diseased version of the great British comedy stock character who is Rigby from Rising Damp, or who is Faulty, or who is Captain Mannering, or who is Anthony Aloysius Hancock.
Yes.
That's to say that there's a dignity and a cravat, and they're somehow aping what they think a proper man would have in terms of a club and being able to tell the woman what to do and complete power over the natives. And they're living in a world where, in fact, they're treated as a shabby little nothing. And they think it's so wrong because I've got... And they sit in their room working themselves up into a fever of fury that somehow...
A farage of fury.
A farage of fury. And it's kind of quite bonkers because... On the one hand, they want to stick up for the old regime. On the other hand, what they most hate is someone like me, who is old regime. Yes. I can't help it. I did go to a public school in Cambridge.
Crikey. You don't fit any of my presumptions or prejudices. How dare you challenge me?
I kind of do in a sense in that I'm, you know, my mother's Jewish, so they can say, oh, yeah, typical bloody Jew. They always hear. It's a mafia, the BBC, it's the Jews and the gays, and they all get together and they, you know, only give each other jobs and all that sort of stuff, you know. I saw in Uganda, I just happened to notice as well, it was such a side issue for our programme, but there was a Ugandan person who was talking about the Indians there, the Asians, and as you know, Idi Amin expelled a huge number of Asians from Uganda, who happened to have British passports, because it was the time when, you know, obviously, Uganda being a British protectorate, and so he thought he would show his power over Britain by expelling them all, and so they all arrived in Britain, and they became a whole generation, almost like the Windrush generation, as it were, of Afro-Caribbeans. And but there were some left who didn't go, and many of the most important companies, you know, your classic big carpet warehouses and things like that, are owned by Asians. And you will hear the Africans, some of the Africans, not all, of course, but the Bagandans, the Ankole people who make up most of Uganda, talking about them in the way that people spoke about Jews. You know, they only give jobs to their own people. They only do that. They only, you know, and they spend all their money on their businesses and education. So, well, yes,
damn them.
Cheating, isn't it? And that's what Jews do as well.
What do you feel when you encounter someone like the Ugandan pastor or probably my favourite moment in the first film is when you suggest to the man offering to cure young gay Americans, you tell him, you point out he's a little bit camp, and I don't know what trickery you used with the cameras, but the look on his face, I mean, he looks like Mr. Humphreys in Are You Being Served? With that precise point in proceedings. It's so true. It's perfect.
He was so affronted. Funnily enough, California's had its revenge, but this particular man, well, I mean, not just this man, but his practice, which is called reparative therapy,
where
anxious parents whose son has come out to them or whose daughter's come out to them, often as young as 12, 10, 11, 12,
sure.
Send them to him. He calls himself a doctor and claims to be able to cure people from being gay. He's actually been outlawed now to use reparative therapy in California, which is where we filmed him, against or on a minor, which I think is right. I mean, even if one did believe that you could change someone's sexuality, to do it while it's still developing, I think, is extremely dangerous and peculiar. And apparently, I spoke to this guy who had been under this peculiar person's care, and he said, you know, all the other boys, you know, I met in the waiting room, and we kind of eyed each other up.
It was
a really good way of meeting boys.
but don't you want to hurt men like
that? Well, some part of one is so angry, but in fact, you hope that history does in the end. Mm. I mean, it's a bit like, it's always too slow. I mean, if we have British blood in our veins, and I do from my father's side, obviously, we have ancestors not that long ago who stirred sugar into coffee, knowing that the sugar and the coffee had been picked and planted by slaves. And they weren't necessarily bad people, you know? They're not every Briton who used sugar.
Or had a child up there,
it was just, you know, we learn, we progress. It's why it's called, you know, being a progressive. And I am more than a liberal, I'm a progressive. I believe in human progress. I believe we learn our morals. Morals is not an eternal truth. That's ethics. Morals is literally Latin for manners, mores. It's the way we behave now. And that changes and it improves now. And we try and, I think, the way we talk and talk about women or talk about people of other races and talk about people of different physical characteristics is better manners. I was talking about going to a party that Nicholas Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, hosted to celebrate the same-sex bill, and some very peculiar person said, congratulations, you have now ensured that the human race will no longer be able to propagate itself. And I don't know where you begin with such an argument. How does he think that gay people marrying will stop human beings propagating?
If he were to watch out there, do you think he might see a chink of light in the darkness of his perspective?
I hope so.
The tiniest chink.
Well, some people's homophobia is so irrational. There was you can find it on YouTube. There's an American pastor who says, you know what I think we should do? We should fence off 100 acres of land, and we should force all the gay people into there, and they throw them food until they die out, and there are no more gay people.
Yes.
And you wanted to put your hand up and say, excuse me, you do know where gay people come from, don't you? We all come from straight people. That's where we all come
that's
from.
That's why he was pitching a reality television show.
In this idea that gay people were a sort of self-serving cycle that reproduced. It's really weird.
And there are moments of that sort of humour, many moments of the humour, but leavened throughout by the tragedy in Out There. I've only seen the first hour, the first film. I look forward to seeing the second. And thank you so much, Stephen Fry,
for
your time.
James.
Thank you.
Stephen Fry talking to James O'Brien on Britain's LBC Radio. And the films he was talking about are called Out There, and you can find them out there in various corners of the internet. That's our special edition of FSN Reports. Let us know how we're doing. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. We are also happy, like Stephen Fry, to chat with you on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. From Washington, goodbye.